Welcome on to our continuing season preview series here on the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. We are joined by KL Chouinard of the Atlanta Hawks official site, but many other places before that. How you doing, man?
Good, thanks.
So this team is one I've been eager to talk about, and one of the reasons is that my outline is actually going to work for this team, and because I usually wanted to start in kind of projecting a team's performance by talking about how good they were the year before, and that, I think, is a very interesting question in getting in to think about what they might do this year. They obviously had the greatest season in franchise history a year ago, made it to the conference finals for the first time, 60 wins for the first time. How much of that do you think can translate to this year?
I think a bunch of it can translate. They won 60 games, but it was actually kind of a rocky start. Before they were winning a bunch of games and were in the spotlight in December and January, they were a pretty mediocre team in November. They were 5-5 to start the season. Horford was, still trying to get used to things. He'd had, pectoral surgery in the summer. Thabo was new, and things didn't look good that first month for Thabo. It was a rough month. That first month was really a learning experience, and his December was incrementally better, and then his January was phenomenal. So, they were pretty patchy at the start of the season. They got they had a couple of close losses early, then they got blown out by Cleveland on just a game where just Cleveland could not miss a shot, and then they lost to the Lakers at home, and that was a tough loss. And so they were 5-5 at the start of the season. It was kind of up in the air what they would look like, and so once Thabo really started to figure things out, really everything changed for them. The last 42 games that Thabo played with the Hawks, and he missed some time in February, I think it was, with a calf injury, and then he had the incident in New York in April. But the last 42 games that Thabo played in, they were 38-4.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable, and I think, as I recall, he shot pretty much 40% on threes after that first rough stretch, although not on perhaps the greatest volume in the world. But that would give you some hope for this year that maybe he can kind of fill the Damari Carroll void a little better than some people might think, because he also had some pretty decent three-point shooting seasons in Oklahoma City until his last year when he really fell off.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we'll be hitting on here is that it's not really so much a question of whether Thabo can fill Damari's role, but then it's a question of, well, who fills Thabo's role if Thabo's going to be, Damari? And so, there's some interesting questions there.
Yeah, Kent Bazemore has impressed me in the preseason, playing 20 minutes a game. He's been hitting his threes, been able to drive to the basket. Not terribly high usage, but looks better than last year's playoffs. What do you think of what he's been able to do so far in the preseason, and do you think he'll be kind of the leading candidate there, or is there going to be some of the other guys they brought in, like Tim Hardaway Jr.?
They've brought Thabo along slowly. He's played, four games now and really hasn't been the starter yet. Bazemore has started 5 out of 6 games. He had one off for rest, but he started the other 5 games. So it really looks like he's going to be the starter to start the season, and he's looked good. He was hitting 3-point shots pretty well for a lot of the last season, but there's a lot of other little things that he's adding to his game. He's looking more comfortable. If he's chased off the 3-point shot, he's looked a lot more comfortable driving it to the rim and either finishing it at the rim, or if that's taken away, finding his teammates. And I think in his passing and his ball handling, those are probably the areas he probably improved in most this summer, because he's really looked good in those departments.
Yeah, and I think we can get a little bit more to kind of what they're going to be missing with Carroll, and whether these guys, maybe even if it's a by-committee approach, can start to approximate what he did. But last year, they had some absolutely dominant stretches with, I forget what it was, like a 17-game winning streak, I think it was, and ultimately finishing 60-22, but even that with quite a bit of resting down the stretch. But on the other hand, their point differential, not necessarily what you would have expected of a 60-win team.
Sure.
They were 56 and 26 a year ago would have been their Pythagorean expected one loss per basketball reference. And then also you have to look at the fact that, well, let's start there. And then they kind of flamed out in the playoffs. They didn't play that well. What happened down the end of the year compared to what they were doing during those amazing stretches in the middle of the year that caused a little bit of a decline?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think part of it part of it was injuries for sure. Horford got dinged up. His shooting hand was messed up. Millsap's shoulder was bad.
I thought that was a very underrated story. He came back in, I want to say it was the Bulls game, which was the last game of the season.
Yep.
And then, just couldn't hit a shot in the playoffs. I felt like either driving to the basket or with his jump shot, and that was with the amount of switching that teams did on them, especially, or just leaving guys open, frankly. They missed so many open jumpers, and he was a big part of that in his disappointing playoffs. Do you think that the injury had a lot to do with that?
Yeah, I think so. He was definitely not the same player, especially in the first round when he was really – I think they would have had a lot easier time taking care of Brooklyn if they'd had a healthy Millsap in that series. And I think he gradually got healthy as the playoffs went along. But, when that's happening, there's really no time to fit in extra practice and – try to get your shot back. Even if you start to get healthy, you're just a little bit out of rhythm at that point.
Yeah, so I thought that was the case. Teague kind of had some little things, sprained ankles, obviously.
Yeah, and I think
they're missing Tabo.
His wrist, too. You seem like a couple times he would just jam his wrist, and he, left one game in the fourth quarter, after he jammed his wrist, and it just seemed like that happened a couple of times. So he had some nagging injuries too, I think.
Yeah, and now, of course, the counter-argument to that is everybody is injured.
Sure.
During the playoffs, and it would be hard to argue that their opponents in the conference finals were less injured than they were, obviously, with Love and Kyrie essentially missing nearly all of the series as well. It was I was a little disappointed in what they did in the playoffs. I actually picked them to beat Cleveland. Then, of course, they kind of got beat in game one. We're getting blown out in game two. So I think they probably could have at least maybe won a game had Korver been available. Then he got injured as well. Damari with that scary knee injury also. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Korver got suspended for one of the games too. So
yeah.
they were down a big part of the lineup by the time they were in game two.
Yeah, that's right. Was it game two that Horford got suspended and then he missed game three? Was that right?
Yeah, it was either
like the one that went into overtime. Was that the one that he missed?
I think so.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of kind of reasons to think like maybe they didn't live up to their potential in the playoffs, just how many open shots they missed as well, and maybe the injuries played a part in that. But overall, I mean, do you think that their record last year, does that kind of, if we're trying to project ahead for this year, does that kind of overstate what they were able to do last year on a season-long basis? Or do you think that that's, when we're projecting this year, we should be starting from a baseline of 60 wins and then kind of pricing in the Carroll departure and the addition of Splitter, et cetera, et cetera?
I mean, last year they were coming off a sub-500 season, and so I don't think when they came into the regular season necessarily they were thinking, okay, let's pace ourselves. We've got to keep ourselves fresh for the playoffs. I mean, they really just needed to prove themselves in any way, shape, or form possible at that point. And I think in this season, the regular season is almost like a dress rehearsal. The East isn't as deep as the West. The Hawks probably feel like they're a lock to be in the playoffs. So, I mean, I think their approach this year is a little bit different. So when we talk about sort of a regular season projection, I think 60 wins probably isn't realistic. I mean, I don't think that's like a target. And I don't know that it's necessarily really a goal either. I think if you look at, if you go by the moniker that the Hawks are Spurs East, the Spurs are routinely a team that finishes between 50 and 60 wins. And really, I don't think they make a big deal out of trying to get to 60 wins. It's more a matter of just being fresh, being ready, and playing your best basketball in April, May, and June. So I think that's going to be more the mindset this year.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about what happened with their offseason. Jamari Carroll, they lost. I thought that Carroll is a very underrated player. I think some people may not agree. Masai Ujiri agrees with me, given the contract that he gave him. He's a 3-and-D guy in a conference that does not have a ton of them, where he's actually above average at both of those things. I think a guy who really helped them get out in transition, as well as defensive versatility to guard 1 through 3. excuse me. And so I don't know that they necessarily have a guy who can do all of those things at once. However, they did pick up Tiago Splitter basically for nothing. And he, I think, really addresses some weaknesses they had last year as well.
Yeah, there's a couple things there. With Splitter, you know, a couple of the things that they weren't really good at last year were, defending in any way above the rim and especially defensive rebounding. They weren't the greatest of defensive rebounding teams last year. I think they were like 22nd, and that's been a big point of emphasis in the preseason, and they've been pretty good at it. But going back to Carroll, you're right. He is an underrated player because, you know, he's a great defender. He can make his open three-point shots. By the time he was in his second year with the Hawks, he really fit in the sense that, you know, the offense and the ball movement was really seamless with him involved. You know, he'd make the right passes, take the shot when it was his turn to take the shot, and he would make them on a regular basis. And so he really fit that offense just about beautifully. And so, you know, they've got players to replace him, and they've got some players that are look like good defenders and look like guys who can hit three-point shots. But I think the one thing that they're going to miss maybe most with Carroll's absence is just size. They have guys who can defend the smaller threes, but maybe not the bigger threes.
Huh. It's interesting that you say that, because I was having a conversation with an executive the other day, and I kind of will admit I had a little bit of a misconception of him just because he was a power forward in his college days. I sort of thought of him, and, you know, he's real intense and can get on the boards a little bit. I thought of him as being stronger. I think he's cut some weight since college, but he really only weighs like 210. So I don't know that he actually is like that much stronger than someone like Tabo defensively. And they probably are about the same from a length standpoint. I think Tabo has pretty long arms. So I don't know that, like, and LeBron just totally bullied him. He had zero chance like standing up to LeBron in the post last year. They basically had to double, which was kind of a disaster for what they wanted to do defensively, especially since Cleveland was hitting, you know, basically all their three-pointers. So I think Tabo is just as good as him for defending from a size standpoint. I think Bazemore, you know, I agree with you there. Splitter, I think, is going to be a massive upgrade for them on the defensive boards, especially where they also got killed by Cleveland. So maybe you can make the argument that they match up a little bit better. My biggest concern is just, again, so much of what they did offensively was based on having five shooters on the floor. And now you're taking away Carroll and you're putting in two guys who, in Bazemore and Tabo, who, even if they do hit the shots at a decent rate, don't have the type of quick trigger that Carroll did. So I think, and I don't think he's are going to be honored as much from a respect standpoint by other defenses as Carroll was. And then you're putting in Splitter for a lot of the minutes as well, rather than Antic. Splitter is a much better player than Antic, but also, again, takes away from the spacing aspect on offense. So I could see them being as good on defense, maybe even a little better defensively this year, but I think the offense is poised to take a step back.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. Just going back to Carroll, I don't know that we got a great sample size of him guarding LeBron in the playoffs. The first half of game one, LeBron did sort of bully him in the post. And I got the sense in that first half of game one that Carroll was just trying to stay out of foul trouble and just kind of, you know, saving what he could save. And then he was hurt after that. And then,
yeah, that's true. When your knee's all messed up, it's really hard to kind of battle in the post. You make a good point
there. But in that first half of game one, LeBron really did sort of get wherever he wanted to go. You're right about, I think that's the question. I think they will be better defensively, and then the question is going to be, you know, can they keep it up on offense? one of the things they're doing, because they want to have the ability to guard bigger threes, is they're using a lineup maybe about 5 minutes a game, 10 minutes a game in the preseason, where they put Millsap at small forward, Horford at power forward, and Splitter at center.
Yeah, and Millsap, actually, I thought was by far their most effective LeBron defender in that game, especially down the stretch of game three. I thought he did really well against LeBron in that series.
Yeah, and I thought down the stretch of game one, too. I do think he was their best defender, and I think what they noticed in that is that he probably is their best chance at guarding LeBron if LeBron is a small forward, but then they have to make it work on offense. And, you know, to make it work on offense, what they were trying to do is they were trying to guard Thompson and Mozgov with super small defenders just so that they could run their regular offense. And that seemed to give them, you know, a little bit of trouble. And so now I think they're making the adjustment of, okay, you know, if we need to use this, even if it's not something we're going to do all the time, we're ready for it. And so I think that's an adjustment that they're making now with eyes towards the postseason.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. So I think Millsap is more versatile than a lot of your type of fours who are going to play down, and he's been working on his ball handling. I think he's better defensively as well than a lot of these fours who try to play down to the three, and that does have the advantage of probably, depending on how Schroeder develops this year, you probably have your five best players on the floor in Teague, Korver, Millsap, Horford, and Splitter are probably their five best guys right now. So has that advantage. On the other hand, the history of four men playing down to the three overall, I think, is generally not that good. And I think a lot of Millsap's offensive advantages are really, you know, what makes him so good. I think he's kind of their big engine, especially as the only guy on the team, maybe other than Teague, who can create a shot late clock going against fours that can't keep up with him or get out to the three-point line at him. It mutes a lot of his offensive advantages when you're playing him there at the three.
Yeah, that's one of the things Budenholzer said, you know, day one coming into the media day and training camp, was that, you know, he liked the additions of Splitter and 7'3" Eddie Tavares, because he thought that their play in the pick and roll game would give them another option to get the ball to the rim. And really, they only had three options to get the ball to the rim last season. It was Teague, Schroeder, and Millsap. You know, they really don't have a lot of ball handlers on the wing that are going to make a move to the basket. And you sort of need that to initiate the ball movement, to initiate everything else that they want to do on offense. You have to sort of first start by having somebody who can go to the rim. And really a big burden fell on Millsap last year. But you're right. I mean, this goes back to the point you brought up earlier, which is there's a trade-off. You know, if Splitter is going towards the rim where Antic was lingering behind the three-point line last year, you're not playing the same kind of four-out or five-out offense that you were last year. And, you know, there's going to be some spacing issues, especially, I think, for Schroeder. I think that's one big question, is can Schroeder operate the same way with the bench unit that he did last year, where he had Antic, you know, dragging defenders out 25 feet away from the hoop? He's going to have more traffic this year. And I think he actually got good experience with that this summer. He was playing with Germany.
He was awesome in that tournament, by the way.
He was really good. He was having to do that against zone defenses. And he also got some experience playing with guys that are good pick-and-roll players as opposed to pick-and-pop players, especially Tibor Pleiss, who's in Utah now. He got a lot of experience kind of feeding him on the roll, and I think that'll help him working with Splitter and Horford and maybe Tavares this year.
Yeah, Splitter is an underrated pick-and-roll player, and you don't think of him that way because he's not going to go catch alley-oops and dunk on your heads the way a lot of guys would do it, but he's excellent, excellent screener in the pick and roll. And then when he gets to the rim, he may not explode and he might get a few shots blocked in embarrassing fashion, but he's also a pretty crafty finisher and can make the next pass as well if there's a guy there waiting to take a charge. So I think that is one aspect that's underrated about what Splitter can do offensively. And he also has experience working in close quarters with another traditional big as well, so that's part of why he's such a good passer. Let's look at one of the reasons why I kind of am a little worried that this team can't repeat what they did last year, even after you price in the Carroll loss, and that is that I think most of these guys on this team, the key guys they're relying on, are on the other side of the aging curve, and then some of them are coming off of injuries as well after what was a pretty healthy season for them. I mean, who do you think of the holdovers is likely to get better? Who's likely to get worse, and who's kind of just going to maintain?
I would say, you know, for the players that are going to be better, I think, you know, for starters, Al Horford, this is the first summer he's really had to work on his game in a long time. He has had, you know, the pectoral surgeries for the last few off seasons. He did not play for the Dominican Republic this summer because he wanted to work on his game. And so I think you're going to see him sort of, you know, ready to sort of take the reins right from the outset. Last year, November was a tough month for him. He really wasn't playing as many minutes. I think he was restricted or, you know, unofficially restricted. He didn't play that well or that much in November just because he was still recovering. And so I think Horford is really set for a big season. And he seems to have added a three-point shot over the season. I know they say that for a lot of people, Anthony Davis.
Yeah, I saw you wrote a piece on that in the last few days.
But really, yeah, he only attempted maybe, I can't remember the exact number, but maybe like five.
I think
or
he said
seven.
36. I just read it 10 minutes ago.
Oh, okay.
So I think it was I think it was 36 three-point attempts last year.
If you take away the corner threes and just look at the above the break threes, he only took maybe five or seven that were above the break all season, and now that's a shot that he'll take three, four, five times a game. Now he's really playing, you know, a lot more like Antic did in the offense last year. He's not taking as many mid-range shots, and he's taking more shots that are really these above-the-break three-point shots. And I think part of that is just he wanted to add it to his game. But I think another part of it is they want him to play that way if he's going to be a power forward next to Splitter.
And do you think he can make those not only spotting up, but in a pick-and-pop situation as well? And you know, I'm not skeptical of that because I think he's been one of the league's best shooters from, you know, the 15 to 23 feet range for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think he can make that shot because the physical mechanics of it is what he's been using for the mid-range for so long. It's just a longer shot, but once you adjust to the distance, it's really going to be the same kind of mechanic that he's been using as a pick-and-pop mid-range player for such a long time.
Yeah, he has, like, somewhat odd form where he kind of, you know, shot puts it up a little bit for lack of a better descriptor. But he does shoot a set shot as well, and I think that that's an easier transition than for guys who shoot a jump shot. You don't have to worry about, like, getting your legs into it as much. So, yeah, and I think he, you know, took those with no hesitation from the corner. It just didn't make sense to have one of your best guys staying in the corner all the time, so he didn't take that many of those. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think that is a reason for optimism. You know, on the other hand, defensively, I think you might just have to, with the effects of age, have to project him to take a little bit of a step back. And he's a very, very underrated defender in terms of the ground that he's able to cover, if not necessarily blocking shots. So what about Millsap? What do you think about him? I mean, and Horford, I think, is going to be 30 this year. Millsap, I want to say, was he going to be 31?
That sounds about right. I mean, I would say, for Millsap, I would just expect more of the same. I really think that, you know, Horford, even though he's a year older, I really think that the summer preparation is going to help him. But with Millsap, you know, I think he's about the same age. I think that really the other Hawk who's going to improve the most is Bazemore. And I know we touched on that earlier, that I think he's a better passer. I think he's just going to benefit from getting more minutes with the starters as well. And he's in his second year in the system. I don't know that they wanted to use Bazemore last year as much as they did. I think they would have preferred to just kind of let him acclimate to the system for a year. But, you know, when Tabo got hurt, you know, he was sort of the next man up. But I think with another year in the system, I think that's going to pay dividends for Bazemore.
Yeah, and this is a team that, especially in the playoffs, whenever they broke up that starting five, they were just totally ineffective. You know, I think the bench was better during the regular season. But yeah, so I think the hope is maybe that Bazemore, especially if he's going to end up starting, and I think maybe that's the right move with Cephalosha coming off the injury and, you know, being a 31 now, maybe starting Bazemore if you can get away with it is the right move, as long as that's, you know, not going to kill that awesome starting unit. So yeah, maybe he'll be better now that he's had some more time in the system, as all of the Hawks were last year, who had been in the system for a year already. What about Schroeder? He's someone who really took some steps forward last year after being really, his rookie year, unplayable. But on the other hand, the advanced metrics, RPM-based stuff, think that he's still one of the worst point guards in basketball. They were not really able to be that effective with him on the floor in the playoffs. Then he had a great Eurobasket. He's got a lot of skills. What are you expecting from him this year, and what do you think he has added to his game over the offseason that might make him more effective in his team impact as well as in the box score?
Just going back to last season for Schroeder, he literally flipped a switch January 1 with regard to his three-point shot. I mean, it was just sort of out of the blue. Like, he was making, you know, probably 20-something percent of his three-point shots in 2014. And then when he got to 2015, he was all of a sudden like a 40% shooter from three, which may be hard to duplicate for the entirety of this season, but I think it indicates that he's definitely making progress in that area. If you watch him after practice and, you know, working with the Hawks, you know, instructional staff, you can see that the thing that he's working on most is working on situations where the defender goes under the screen.
Yeah, that killed them in the playoffs, too, cause it, when he shot only 8 out of 34 in the playoffs last year. So I think that's a great thing for him to be working on, frankly.
Yeah, so pretty much, you know, anytime you see him working after practice with Kenny Atkinson, what you'll see is he's working on that, you know, just getting ready for the pull-up, rescreening, whatever he can do to sort of counteract what happens when defenders go under screens.
Yeah, well, and obviously just at his age, some of his physical talent as well. I'd like to see him get maybe a little bit more creative finishing at the basket. It's basically just floaters and speed layups. I'd like to see him get a little bit more than that, because you know, if he's in a situation where he's not just beating his guy to the goal, you know, a lot of times he'll get it blocked or have to rush it up there in a way where it's a, you know, not a high percentage shot. But yeah, and what about you know, Splitter? I guess is 30. It's hard to really talk about what he did last year. What about Korver? I mean, Korver had by far the best season of his career last year at age 33. It's absolutely remarkable the fact that he is a better player now than he was when he was 27, 28, 29. You know, I think he would probably credit a lot of that to his work at P3, which he started doing, you know, later on in his career. But do you think there's any chance he can be as good as he was last year?
It's going to be hard. When I asked him about this kind of stuff the other day, he sounded, you know, a little bit challenged with trying to get ready for the season in a minimum amount of time. You know, he's definitely a guy who likes to have a routine. He likes to prepare. You know, working with P3, like you said, is something that's been really, really good for him. And he's, you know, he's just one of those people that's all about routine and preparation. And he didn't get that this summer. He had to do rehab. And, you know, I think that was really hard for him. He even said, you know, it was tough, you know, from a family point of view. He didn't get to, you know, do stuff that he wanted to do because he was rehabbing. So, you know, I think that was a really hard summer for him. It's interesting because, you know, he's 34, but at the same time, like you said, he's playing better now than he did when he was 27, 28. And when he was 27, 28, he didn't play that many minutes. So when you compare him to the typical 34-year-old, it's kind of different. He's not one of those guys that, you know, started playing in the NBA, you know, 1 year of college and started playing at 19. He played as an older player and he didn't play that many minutes. So I think he's only played like 20-something thousand minutes in his career, which is really, I think, relatively low for a player of his caliber. And so, you know, he said that, you know, he's not 100%, but he feels like he'll be in a good place somewhere very soon. And so, you know, we'll have to see. It's certainly an interesting situation. I think one thing that works in his favor that people always underestimate is how big he is. And I think that just helps him as a defender. It helps him as a shooter. It helps him as a rebounder. He's really a big player. You put him next to Millsap, and they look like they're pretty much the same size.
Yeah, that is something that's underrated, as is his positional defense. Absolutely. As well. I think that's something that he's real good at. He's real good at coming over, stripping guys when he's helping out, and pretty solid on the boards for a shooting specialist as well. Where are he and Tabo at right now from a health standpoint?
I mean, I think they're both at the point where they're going to play in the season. I would say Korver, you know, probably will play regular minutes. It seems like in the preseason, he kind of goes in and out with Horford in terms of rotation. They're usually the first guys to the bench in the first quarter for substitutes. But I think he can still sort of work a regular minute slow. They did this last year with Horford, you know, at the beginning of the season. Horford would play, you know, maybe 28, 29 minutes a game, but they would do it in 6-7 minute intervals. They wouldn't play him more than that at a time. And I think you'll probably see something like that for Korver too. I think he's a little bit further along than Tabo. Tabo missed a couple of preseason games. I think he's played 4 preseason games now, and his minutes went from 8 to 14 to 19. He may have actually played a little bit less last night because that was the one game they treated as like a full dress rehearsal, and they played the starters a lot of minutes. But, you know, I think Tabo's probably ready to play 20 minutes a game or so. And again, you know, he's not 100%. He's trying to get a feel for it. And again, you know, the thing about Korver and Tabo is those were probably the two guys that would have just taken so many just jump shots this summer. Korver, just because he always does. Tabo, I think that was like the one thing he really, you know, wanted to work on. And, you know, they were both kind of killed in the fact that they had to do rehab instead of really working on their game.
Yeah, and Tabo, too, part of the other problem with him is that even when he makes his shot, he takes an hour to get it off. And so that's kind of, as far as just presenting that spacing threat, which I think, you know, we're starting to have more and more of a realization that is just as important as whether the shot actually goes in, is whether, you know, you can get the shot off, whether guys can't leave you. That's something I'm going to be watching pretty closely this year. So explain the Tim Hardaway trade to me. What is the organization's rationale for that? This is a guy who was not really very effective in New York by pretty much any advanced metrics, has some talent. He had a great game against the Hawks. Some cynics have said, well, towards the end of the year, that's why they got him, just because Coach Bud is in control, and he was impressed by that. But what is the organization's rationale behind Tim Hardaway, and where is he going to fit in to this wing mix that we've been talking about?
I think if you talk to people in the Hawks enough, you get a sense of some of the things that just they prefer from an organizational philosophy. And I think that, you know, a couple of things that they prefer is they like having big wings. And, you know, Hardaway is 6'6". Another thing that they talk about with regularity is they like, you know, mid-prime players. They're not a team that routinely, you know, turns things over to, you know, a 19 or a 20 or even like a 22-year-old who's not ready. I mean, they did that for Schroeder, but, you know, Schroeder is almost sort of a prodigy in the fact that, you know, by the time he was thrown into regular minutes last season, he was ready. They use the D League a lot. They really don't use their team as a training ground for kids that aren't ready yet. So they like more mature players, and, you know, they like big wings, and I think Hardaway sort of fit the bill. And at the time that they acquired him, I think another thing that was a consideration was just, you know, the overall cap sheet. Because when they acquired him, you know, they were still didn't know, can we get Millsap back? Can we get Carroll back? And so if they were going to make a move for a mid-career player, they also had to take in consideration price. And I think Hardaway fit their price at that point.
Yeah, and I like the overall strategy there. I think that, especially with wings being so scarce, there are a lot of wings that have been drafted a year or two earlier that are kind of languishing on people's benches. I thought that was a good move in theory to go after someone who might be an undervalued asset who could potentially contribute. But also, I mean, just his defensive numbers, and also not even really that great of a shooter. He's been shooting about 35% in his career? Do they just think that they can fix him defensively? Is that the rationale?
Yeah, I think we got a few things. One is, you know, they did say, you know, the day they signed him and held the press conference, they said, you know, we're excited to have him work with our development staff. So they want to, you know, they realize, I think, that they want to teach him and bring him along. I think a couple of other things is that if you look at the types of shots that he's always been good at, his three-point shot has been especially good from, like, the side, from the wings. And I think that ties in with what they want to do with him, which is they want him to be the backup shooting guard or the backup Korver. They want his role to be what Korver's is. And this goes back to what we were talking about before. You know, what minutes can Korver play? Well, they want to have somebody that can spell Korver. They didn't really have that last year. They had John Jenkins, who looks like he's having a fine preseason with Dallas, but I don't know that they trusted him defensively. I don't know that they liked his size. And so they really didn't utilize a backup Korver or a backup shooting guard last year. They had backups for Carroll. Bazemore was a backup for Carroll. Tabo was a backup for Carroll, but they didn't really have a good replacement for Korver. And, you know, Budenholzer has said, yeah, if you look at anybody on the team, you know, we want Hardaway to sort of do what Korver does. And so I think they see him, you know, fitting a mold where he moves without the ball, gets the ball on the wings and gives them, you know, spacing and shooting in a way that Korver does. And, you know, obviously he has a long way to go because Korver is, you know, a ridiculous freak in his productivity. But they think that he can sort of, you know, do that as a backup and give that type of skill to them.
So some of the younger guys on the roster, I'm going to give you a couple of names here. Tell me whether you think they're where they're at, you know, whether they can contribute this year, or what the thought is really for them in the future. Let's start with Eddie Tavares, 7'3", played for Gran Canaria in Spain a year ago. He was a draft pick in 2014. What are the organizational thoughts on him? Is he going to play at all this year? What has he looked at for the future?
It's interesting, because, you know, again, like I said, you know, the Hawks, if you talk to them, they talk about, you know, how they like mature players and they like to have players in the middle of their prime. And with Tavares, I think the thinking is, you know, let's bring him along slowly. He's going to need time to develop, but then they've played him and he's looked really good. He only touched the basketball for the first time 6 years ago as a 17-year-old. And I don't know, maybe that's been an advantage for him because, you know, if you watch him play, he's fundamentally very, very sound. You know, he's 7'3", but when it's time to rebound, he boxes out before he tries to go get the rebound. He doesn't just try to go get it because he's 7'3" and figures, hey, I can reach over them anyways. He'll get good position before he wants to rebound. And he was the leading rebounder in, you know, what's probably the second best basketball league in the world in Spain. He led that league in rebounds a season ago. So he looks like a really good rebounder. Obviously, with his size, you know, he's 7'3 with a 7'9 wingspan. His hands are probably 11 inches across. He's just enormous. And so when he's defending in the paint, he can really sort of, you know, muck things up for the opponents. There's just not a lot of space for them to operate in the paint when he's down there. And he looks like he understands the Hawks' offense and defense. Not to the point where it's second nature, but enough to the point where he knows where he's supposed to be and he's getting there. Even if he hesitates a little bit, he knows what he's supposed to be doing out there. So it'll be interesting to see if they feel like they can use him in any real way. The Hawks don't have a D-League affiliate, but of all the teams that don't have a D-League affiliation, they probably use it the most. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him, you know, in a D-League uniform, maybe the Austin Spurs. They seem to have a good tie-in there if they can come to some sort of agreement. They play similar systems. So they might put him in the D-League, but they might be using him for, you know, spot duty on occasion. The one thing that's going to be a problem for him is foul trouble. But, you know, if they just want 5-10 minutes a game, that's not really an issue.
How about Mike Muscala and Mike Scott, just briefly on those guys.
I think that's maybe the key rotational question for the Hawks. I mean, I think, you know, last night they had their dress rehearsal, if you will. They played 10 players. And Budenholzer said ahead of time, you know, I'm probably giving one of my bigs the night off. And that big happened to be Mike Scott. But, you know, in the one game that was their dress rehearsal, you know, their backups were Schroeder, Cephalosha, Tim Hardaway Jr., Splitter, and Muscala. And so in the regular season last year, Scott was in the rotation. By the time we got to about the Washington series in the playoffs, he'd really been supplanted by Muscala. You know, Scott's a really good offensive player, but Muscala probably approximates most of that offense with screens, and, you know, he's a really, really good shooter. And he's bigger and probably gives him a little bit more on defense, so.
Yeah, Scott is a pretty big mess. I would even say massive liability on the boards. You know, he kind of he's almost like a small forward in that sense. And defensively, I think he kind of spaces out a little bit more than Muscala does. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I agree with you to see Muscala kind of supplant his minutes as the fourth big. And the way Bud does his rotations and not playing guys too many minutes, that's actually a guy who's going to play significantly.
Yeah, and I think that Scott will still have a role. I think, you know, one of the things we'll see is I don't think Splitter is an 82-game player. You know, when you look at the guys who probably are, you know, the Hawks are a little bit worried about health-wise, you know, obviously Korver and Cephalosha, but then probably after that you'd get to Splitter and say, okay, we really want him to be healthy for the playoffs. How can we do that? And I think they're probably going to pace him accordingly. And so, you know, Scott, even if Muscala takes some of Scott's minutes, I think Scott will still have a role, you know, just in terms of trying to keep all their guys healthy for the long run.
Yeah, that's a great point about Splitter, who's struggled with some of these kind of nebulous calf/nerve issues, and arguably the fact that he wasn't healthy might have meant that might have been the reason why the Spurs ultimately lost that series to the Clippers last year. So let me ask you this. What is your what do you think will be the crunch time lineup? Obviously, I think you can count on Teague, you can count on Korver, Horford, Millsap as being locks. Who's that fifth guy going to be?
I would say that, you know, they're going to do one of a few things. One is they could just go with whoever is the hot hand that night. And again, I think you'd be choosing there between Bazemore and Cephalosha. Or, you know, you could do an offense-defense thing, which I think they got into a little bit last night with a close game in Memphis. And, you know, you probably use maybe Bazemore on the offensive end and Cephalosha on the defensive end. But then if you go offense-defense, you could do Bazemore-Cephalosha. You could do Bazemore-Splitter. And I think you might see that in certain situations as well, where if you go offense, defense, you know, put Bazemore in for your offensive possessions and then put Splitter in for the defensive side. So I think, you know,
you think we'll see any 2-point guard lineups?
What's that?
You think we'll see any 2-point guard lineups with Schroeder and Teague?
You know, last season, like I said, they had trouble getting the ball to the rim, and so I think the 2-point guard lineup was a good option for them because it gave them more ways of getting the ball to the rim, and I don't know that they love that idea defensively as much as they like it offensively.
Schroeder, I thought, had some encouraging signs guarding Bradley Beal in the playoffs, and at times they went to Carroll on John Wall in that Washington series, and Schroeder guard Beal. He has more length than you would think he does, but he also weighs like about 165. So that's, I mean, anybody with some size is going to take him down in the post might not. But I think in some matchups, it could work for them.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you just sort of tick off, you know, who are the Hawks' 5 or 6 best players, I think Schroeder definitely gets in there. And so I think one of the things that's going to be a big issue for the Hawks, just like it was last year with Cephalosha, is I think learning the way Budenholzer wants his wings to play takes time. It took Cephalosha some time to adjust. It took Bazemore almost a whole season to adjust. And so they want to have Tim Hardaway Jr., you know, in the rotation, but I think it's just going to take a, you know, just take some time. And so, you know, if they can't get Tim Hardaway Jr. maybe into the flow of things as fast as they would like, I think maybe the backup option to is to shift some of those minutes to Schroeder and play more 2-point guard stuff, just because they have to figure out a way to get him minutes, because like I said, he really is probably one of their 5 or 6 or 7 best players.
We haven't talked about Jeff Teague at all. What's he been working on? What's kind of the next step for him? He had an all-star year. I think most people would say probably a little bit of a disappointing playoffs, but he also still is young enough that he's going to be 27 this year. So right about in his prime, he might regress a little bit. He might improve a little bit, but what are you expecting from him this year?
I think he'll be great. One of the things that Budenholzer was saying, I want to say it was during training camp, they went to University of Georgia. And, you know, I think he was asked about, you know, how can Teague improve? And I think the one thing he said is we want him to be better without the ball. You know, they want to play a motion offense. And, you know, they said, Budenholzer said, you know, if he works better off the ball, and, you know, he gives the ball up and keeps working off the ball will come back to him again. And so I think that's something that they want him to work on. And I think that also kind of plays to the 2-point guard lineup again. You know, they want him to have that skill of working off the ball, because when they'd use the 2-point guard lineup, I don't think Schroeder's ready to work off the ball, whereas Teague, being a more mature player, probably is. Even if he isn't everything they want him to be in that department yet, I think he's still way ahead of Schroeder. So I think they want him to function more as a wing and have him be ready for that situation so they can use the 2-point guard lineup.
Yeah, I think for Teague, too, just continuing to refine his jump shot as well. That, again, was a weakness in the playoffs where they went under on him quite a bit as well in the Cleveland series, or when they switched someone like Tristan Thompson onto him, he wasn't really able to make him pay by shaking loose for a jump shot. All right, so this is the big time here. Give me your predicted record for the Hawks in the 2015-16 season.
I would say that they're probably going to win 55 or 56 games, somewhere around there.
Yes, there it is. It's the everyone who's been on this podcast has gone over, except for two people. So for the Vegas over under, I guess. So
I think
were
the
you
Hawks
really
have a good track record of beating the over though? Or
yeah, no, that you make a good point there. Although I think they were under in 2014, but that was the Horford injury, obviously, was part of that. All right, so why do you think they're going to be so good then?
I think, you know, I just think that the core of you know, Teague, Millsap, Korver, and Horford is just a really good core. I think Horford especially, it's the first time that he's really been fully healthy, fully prepped for a season in such a long time, and he's a great player. I mean, you know, he's one of those players who was a top three draftee who's lived up to the billing really in every sense, and, you know, probably doesn't get enough credit for what a good player he is. And he's squarely in the middle of his prime. I think, you know, when your best player is poised to have one of his best seasons, that and you were a 60-win team the year before, I just think that bodes really well. And there are definitely question marks, I think. And I, like I said, I don't think 60 wins is a realistic goal or a goal that they really want to shoot for. I think what they're shooting for is the postseason. So I don't think they're going to go full throttle necessarily. And so I don't know. I just somewhere in the mid-50s seems about right.
Well, it's interesting because as we talked about at the top of the show, their expected one loss last year was 56-26. They were 6th in offense by points per possession, and they were 6th in defense by points per possession. So do you think it's going to be, in terms of the offense-defense, a similar type of mix, or do you think they'll get to your predicted win total by a different kind of mix of offense and defense than that?
Yeah, I don't know that the offense has looked that great, and the defense has actually looked better. Maybe that's just a function of it being the preseason, but I think a function of being bigger, playing more of the, you know, playing, you know, number one, playing splitter, number two, playing, you know, splitter Horford Millsap lineups, and maybe three playing Tavares, I think they're just going to be a lot more solid keeping scoring away from the rim. And when you mix that with guys like Cefalosha, Korver, and Millsap, who all have amazing hands on defense, I think they're going to be a really good defensive team. And I think, you know, the questions you've raised with regard to spacing, especially when you get into the bench, probably not going to have the same effectiveness on offense. So I would say that the offense goes dips a little bit and the defense gets a little bit better.
Yeah, my prediction would be actually a little bit closer to their over-under, and a couple of reasons for that. One, I think, is they're just really going to miss Carroll. Two is, you know, that I'm kind of starting with them from a 56-win baseline just because that was their point differential. So I'm starting there. I'm kind of subtracting for the fact that I think they're going to miss Carroll. And while Splitter, I think, is a good player and adds some elements they didn't have last year, in terms of the fit, he's just not going to play as many minutes, probably won't play as many games due to injury. And it's just it's harder to get him on the floor with all the best players. And I think the downgrade from Carroll to some of those other wing guys could be significant. Another thing that I think nobody is really talking about with this team is health. They didn't really have, other than Tabo at the end of the year, did not really have a significant injury last year. Pretty much all the games that were missed were due to rest. And so among their kind of core four guys, those four guys who made the All-Star team, nobody really missed much time other than, you know, you did note that Horford was kind of getting back in the swing of things the first month or so. So I think the odds are one of those guys is going to miss some time. Then also there's the age-related regression as well. And I will say that if anybody can avoid that, it's this Hawks team because they did the exact same thing last year where you had guys like Horford, Millsap, Korver, who improved even at an age where you would expect them to decline. And I really believe in what the Hawks do from a player development standpoint. But I think I can't, in good conscience, pick that to outweigh just the general trend of aging that we've seen since time immemorial, basically. And so, yeah, I think that's ultimately how I get to kind of being between 48 and 50 wins for this team or so. But I certainly understand, and I'm sure most people in Atlanta are probably thinking that they're going to be better than that.
Yeah, and I think the Eastern Conference as a whole will be better. I think, you know, I think not exponentially better, but I think there are going to be more teams like the Knicks, you know, the Pistons, that they're going to be more competitive this year if they can stay healthy. And if, you know, there may be those teams that always, you know, lose a huge player at the beginning of the year and then decide, let's just get a good lottery spot. But, you know, barring something like that, I think the Eastern Conference will be a little bit more competitive. So you won't have necessarily as many games in March and the beginning of April where you're just playing an opponent that has no interest in winning.
What do you see as the best case scenario for this team? Let me start there. So you gave your predicted record. What's your predicted playoff finish?
Ooh, predicted playoff finish. I mean, I think they'll get into the second round of the playoffs, and, you know, from there they're going to have some challenges. I think, you know, Washington's going to be really good. Cleveland's going to be really good. I'm not as sold as other people are on, you know, Miami and Chicago. I think Washington and Cleveland, you know, if they meet them in the playoffs and both teams are fully healthy, you know, I think those are going to be really competitive series.
Yeah, I agree. Are there any of those teams, other than Cleveland, obviously, any of the teams kind of, you know, we can throw the Raptors into the mix with those teams you mentioned, that you think the Hawks match up especially well or poorly with?
I think they would match. I don't know. Did you include Miami in the mix? I think they would match Miami. I think if you put the Hawks against Miami in a playoff series, I think they'd probably fare pretty well.
Yeah, that would be, those teams are kind of polar opposites, right? Like Miami has a ton of individual talent that they're going to struggle to get to fit together, maybe a shooting deficit. And then the Hawks are kind of, you know, not to say that the Hawks don't have individual talent, but the Hawks are kind of more than the sum of their parts. I think a lot of people kind of think that Miami, at least for the start of the year, might be less than the sum of their parts. So yeah, that would be a fascinating series. And I tend to agree with you, especially if they can space out a guy like Whiteside with Horford, that, and then, you know, getting into some of those bench bigs that Miami has as well, they're not going to be able to get out on the perimeter. So I do think that you're, and then who on that team guards Korver? I guess it would be Luol Deng. I don't think that Dragic is a great matchup for Teague or Schroeder. So you're right. I think that the Hawks do match up pretty well with Miami. Or any of those teams that you find, you know, a troublesome matchup for the Hawks?
It's interesting. I think Cleveland is trouble. I think Tristan Thompson. I don't know. I'm not a Tristan Thompson expert, but in that series, he really gave them fits. So I would say, you know, Cleveland, especially if Thompson is playing well and maybe playing more minutes than Love, I think that that's a series that would be a really tough series.
Yeah, I agree with you. So give me your best case, worst case for this Hawks team, both record and playoff finish.
Best case, worst case.
And by worst case, I don't mean like Al Horford misses the whole year or something. Just, you know, when you have kind of normal injuries, but, you know, maybe things just don't go as well as you hope.
You know, barring massive injuries, I would say that probably, you know, best case is maybe 59 wins and worst case is like 47 wins. If they're healthy, you know, if they have, you know, two starters go down at the same time, you know, then maybe they're a 43 win team or something. But if they only lose, you know, a starter for a month or something like that, and they're healthy for most of the season, I think that sort of a minimum, they're going to win 46 or 47 games. And then I think if things go right, if somehow the conference gets less competitive, you know, if they have a phenomenal month or something like they did last season, I think they could get up to 59 or 60 again.
Yeah, I would shift that maybe down by kind of about four wins. I'd say best case is about 56 and worst case is kind of 45, 46 area. So last question I have for you then, how would you assess the job that, you know, the team's ownership and front office has done? I mean, obviously it's a relatively new regime, especially from an ownership standpoint, but I know you wanted to talk about like some of the things that they've been doing maybe behind the scenes with this Hawks team.
I think for all grading purposes, I think it's just sort of incomplete, but with positive feedback in you know, the months that they've been around. With regard to ownership, I know that, you know, they've come out and said, you know, we're looking to start a D-League team, which really matches, I think, what Budenholzer wants, because they've used the D-League a lot, even though they don't have an affiliate. And, you know, they're looking to build a practice facility, so I think that's something that's, you know, a plus on the ownership side. So, you know, in just a few months, you get the sense that that they're trying to work on things. Even in Phillips, you know, you see a lot of renovations on, you know, the weight. You can see that they're working on a weight room and a players' lounge, and they're trying to make things better in Phillips for the players. And then, you know, even with regard to, like, you know, the general managing, you know, Budenholzer's really only done it a year. I don't know that they made any huge transactions last year, so really the one transaction I think that Budenholzer really has is Hardaway for, you know, the draft pick. And, you know, it's way, way, way too early to tell if that's a smart move or a silly one. So I don't, again, you know, I think you'd have to just say incomplete on there and say we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think, and if you go back a little bit further to the Danny Ferry regime, I mean, I think it's pretty solidly an A. I mean, if you look at where this team was when he took over, the Joe Johnson trade was a coup, and then just getting this team from sort of a perpetual, you know, I mean, I think that most people were thinking they're kind of locked into the 7th-8th seed area, and then to have the season that they had last year and still maintain salary cap flexibility every year is absolutely remarkable. The Hardaway trade, I am a little more down on than you are, if only because he just, by pretty much any metric you look at, is not an effective player in his first 2 years. And they gave up You know, they had the 15th pick that they started with. I think it was one or two second round picks that they got for moving down to 19.
I think they moved down twice and got a second round pick each time, and then maybe cumulatively, if you look at it, I think they have two. I think they have one coming in 2016 and one coming in 2019 from that.
Okay, so you know, I think that's fine to move down there and get those second round picks, but then to take Hardaway instead of the 19th pick when you had some guys who might be pretty big contributors. I would have loved to have seen what like a guy like Bobby Portis could have done on this roster. I think he actually would have fit in amazingly well in the long term with what they're trying to do. But they did need help on the wing. Hardaway does have talent. You're right that it is too early to decide that. You know, certainly I reserve the right to change my opinion once we see him in the system. And if there's anybody I trust to do a good job in helping develop someone, it's this Hawks team. But on the surface, trading the 19th pick for a guy who basically was kind of, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel from an advanced stats standpoint these first couple of years is a curious move, at least in my mind.
Yeah, I hear you. I've thought Portis would have been a great fit. Of all the players that might have been available when they were picking, you know, I thought Portis was a really great talent. And it's interesting because, you know, the Hawks, that was the Nets pick. And so the Hawks, you know, if they're as successful as at least I think they will be, they're not going to be picking in that situation anytime in the near future. And actually, I should mention that when we were talking about grading sort of management, one other move that Budenholzer does have on his record that's starting to look really good, I think, is that he traded Adrian Payne for a lottery protected first round pick from Minnesota.
Yeah, that was a solid sunk cost move there. Because I think Payne is looking like a guy who's going to kind of flame out. And at 23, they had half a year with him. If it looked like he was not going to be in the rotation, they also needed to get rid of him just to open up a little more space in the summer, too, at the time when they were hoping to retain Carroll, re-sign Millsap, or then, you know, they still had space to get Splitter when they couldn't re-sign Carroll. That's an excellent point. I think that move, although it's a lottery-protected first-round pick they're not going to see for a while, getting that much for Payne, who I think is going to end up kind of flaming out, was a nice move.
Yeah, I think Payne's going to get buried in Minnesota behind Bielitsa. They have so many bigs now with Towns and Garnett, and, you know, Payne's probably going to end up being like the sixth big for Minnesota.
And he's 24 already, you know? I mean, I think I understood the idea behind drafting him. I mean, and I guess you'd have to, well, that wasn't quite the Budenholzer regime yet. You'd have to look at that as kind of a failed pick if you're basically punting 3 years into the future for a pick that probably won't be quite as high. It was the 15th pick in 2014. But I understood why they liked him. He has good athleticism, can shoot the ball, even if he takes an hour to get it off. But I think, you know, it was good of them to just realize that was a sunk cost and get what they could before, you know, it's like the drive. I always say that these draft picks are like driving the new car off the lot. Unless they perform immediately, their value goes down very significantly. And so to be able to still get something for him at the time, like if they're trying to trade him now, there's no way they could get that much for him, and he wouldn't have played at all between then and now.
Right. And I think, I mean, I'm sort of separating it in my mind as sort of the draft was when Ferry was around. The trade was when Ferry wasn't around, and I don't know. I'm sure we'll never know, you know, who was influencing decisions. But if you sort of separate it from a Ferry and Budenholzer's perspective, it looks good on Budenholzer's record that he made that trade. If you sort of look at both moves in total, drafting and trading, it's like a wash.
Yeah. No, I get what you mean there. And another thing we should add too is that they've really been staffing up, even in the front office. As well, they brought over Malik Rose to be in the front office. Jeff Peterson, who's a promising young personnel guy, they brought him in recently, gave him a promotion. John Treloar from the Suns organization is another guy they brought in. So they're getting, and they promoted Wes Wilcox to general manager. So they're assembling a deeper staff in the front office, and of a bunch of very well respected guys around the industry.
Yeah, and the one move that I think is maybe being underrated a little bit when you think about it is they took the core of Golden State's training staff in the offseason which you, I don't know, I certainly wouldn't have expected that given that Golden State won the championship and all that, but they're,
yeah, that's going to be really interesting.
They're moving
that's going to be
in a
really
direction
interesting.
Where they're paying more attention to biometrics. They're using wearable tech for the first time this season, and that's something that's going to be really big. I think with the new training people that they brought over from Golden State, Budenholzer has experience with it from his time in San Antonio, but then in his first couple of years here in Atlanta, I don't think they did as much with it. And now with this new training staff, they're getting back into that. And, this training staff, if you look at what they did in Golden State, they've got a really good track record to build on, right? I mean, Golden State, part of the reason people are saying, oh, Golden State is lucky. Well, they were healthy. Well, part of that is having a great training staff. And I think they did. And some of those people, some of those key people are now in Atlanta.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. They had this great health record, although there are rumors even throughout the season that they're a little dissatisfied and that they'd be wouldn't be renewing the contracts of some of those guys. And then Golden State brought in some guys from Australia, one of whose it's Lachlan. I can't remember the guy's last name. I'll need to learn it, but I can't pronounce it quite yet. And they supposedly are much more into that kind of wearable tech stuff, and now those guys are being brought in to do the same thing in Atlanta that, maybe Golden State moved on from them for not doing enough of. So I don't know. It's going to be really interesting to see how all that plays out, especially because Golden State just statistically is probably almost certain to be more injured this year, but maybe, they're close to the situation and they have an idea of the process. And, I think the reporting was that the Hawks wanted to upgrade their training staff as well. All right. So thanks so much for coming on. Was there anything else that struck you about this team that you wanted to share that we didn't get a chance to get to?
No, I don't think so. I think that's pretty much all of it.
All right, good. Then my outline was pretty thorough, which is good to hear. All right, well, thanks so much for coming on. Where can we follow you on Twitter and your work with the Hawks?
It's KL Chouinard, and it's just, hawks.com. or www.nba.com/hawks. Either one of those will get you to the site. But my last name is Chouinard. So it's K.L. Chouinard.
Awesome. All right. Thanks so much for coming on. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Keep up with my writing. I'm serious this time. I'm going to be writing some stuff for Nylon Calculus very soon on rookie extensions. So make sure to check that out with the Warriors. Also, hoping to write a piece just very briefly on what the Tristan Thompson situation is going to mean for the Cavs' future flexibility and luxury tax payments going forward as well in the next couple of days. So if you go to my Facebook page, you'll find links to both of those. If you would like to support the podcast, the CapSpace, all one word, code on SeatGeek if you're trying to get tickets, or DraftKings with the NBA starting if you want to have some fun with Daily Fantasy. It's a great way to do so. Also, if you want to give us an iTunes rating or ranking, that is greatly appreciated. Or just tell a friend about the podcast. That's another great way to spread the word, and we really appreciate that. So thanks so much to KL for coming on, and we will talk to you all next time.
Thank you.